This is Terrence McNally, and this week I'm going to share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with Ralph Nader about his book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. This interview originally aired in November 2012. Ralph Nader and I are recording this interview Wednesday, October 3rd, hours before the first debate between President Obama and Mitt Romney. Nader has a new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future, in which he offers ambitious but common sense solutions to our chronic economic and social problems. And I plan to focus, for the most part, on how Ralph sees us changing the system beyond presidential politics, given the reality that the current election campaign reveals. How and where does he see us working toward achieving these 17 bold ideas? Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Ralph Nader was recently named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history, one of only four living people to be so honored. The son of immigrants from Lebanon, he's launched two major presidential campaigns and founded or organized more than 100 civic organizations. His groups have made an impact on tax reform, atomic power regulation, tobacco industry, clean air and water, food safety, access to health care, civil rights, congressional ethics, and much more. He's the author of 11 books, including Unsafe at Any Speed, The Good Fight, The 17 Traditions, and his latest, 17 Solutions. Welcome again, Ralph Nader, to Free Forum.
Thank you, Terrence.
You were born in 1934 in the midst of the Depression, and you graduated college in 1955. Looking back, do you recall what America looked like to a young grad at that moment and how you might have imagined your life and career?
Well, it looked like it was a pretty stable society that wasn't moving ahead in accordance with its potential. In the mid-50s, it was all about fighting communism when it came to foreign military policy in the Soviet Union. And that kind of obsession was reflected in the warning by President Eisenhower to pay some attention to the military-industrial complex and its diversion of public tax revenues and constantly hyping the adversaries in order to get more budget and draining away money from what Eisenhower called the civilian economy, which he took to mean public transit, schools, and other things that are needed for good society. And, of course, there was the Joe McCarthy hysteria. So we shouldn't idealize past decades, except the 60s and early 70s, where the corporations were thrown on the defensive, surprisingly, because enough people went for the environmental goals, the consumer protection goals, some labor moves. And this was, you know, in the middle of the Vietnam War. So what needed to be looked at was how do you mobilize people in communities? And nobody has found, you know, the elixir here to do it. But I want to, in this book, 17 Solutions, bring it down to scale so people start feeling, you know, it's not as hard as we thought to turn the country around, to have redirections that are long overdue, that are practical, that are supported by a majority of the American people, conservatives and liberals. So the promise of this book is to put in people's hands the feeling that they can do it and they can intersect with any one of these 17 solutions depending on their own desire, a temperament, experience, locale. And then once they enter the civic arena, then there's no stopping people. It's so gratifying. It just gives more meaning to life. And the cover shows basically a New England town.
Is that Winsted?
There was a, you know, a town meeting, the ultimate democracy. It was the city council. Then there was the town meeting if the city council didn't do what the people wanted. And then if the people didn't want didn't do what the town meeting wanted, they'd go right to referendum. So it's the most pristine form of democracy. And yet, half of the people don't turn out or vote. So there are many, many tools we have right now in our hands that we're not using. And a smarter way of voting, higher expectation levels. Look at the debates. People have low expectation levels, and the politicians oblige them.
Yeah. On that cover, that picture, is that Winsted? Is that where you're from?
Or
is
no, it, it's, no just, it's not Winsted.
It's just a typical New England town. It's interesting, yeah. Actually, talking about our American future, and the picture sort of harkens back to an American past when people were more involved. Let me ask you one other thing about your path. I normally start all my interviews by asking guests to briefly tell us about the path to where they find themselves today and the work they're doing. Now, given how long you've been on that path, that seems almost quaint. But when you look back, are there some major turning points where you went, I've got to move this way, and then you went, you know what, this path isn't working, I've got to shift this way, just so people get a sense you've accomplished so much and had a hand in so much that we see, you know, writ large in society, but the personal Ralph Nader, the choices you've made?
Well, the first choice is I had a lucky choice of parents. So that was very good.
Well done.
The next choice was at law school, and I saw my classmates, you know, sharpening their pencils to go into the big corporate law firms in New York, Boston, Chicago, L.A., and I didn't want to do that. I went to law school to have a skill to advance justice, to be able to use my advocacy knowledge of the law, civil liberties, civil rights, consumer protection, environmental, labor. And so that was a turning point. I turned away from the general drift of my hundreds of classmates.
And just so I can say that, I think you were Princeton class of 55 and then Harvard Law, right? So you were with the folks who were doing exactly what you say, sharpening their pencils to be the elite.
That's right. And the important thing about that juncture was I latched on to something that was my third year law school paper, which is titled The Unsafe Automobile Design and the Need for Regulation of Automobiles for Operational Safety and Crash Protection. That continued after law school, and I pushed and pushed. Didn't get anywhere at the state legislative level. And finally, I connected with congressional committees. And in 1966, Lyndon Johnson signed the two critical bills, the highway safety and the motor vehicle safety laws, which irregularly enforced, saved over a million lives and are still working and changing the technologies in motor vehicles for any country that wants to enter the U.S. market, import or domestic. The second major shift occurred when the Democrats began raising money from the same corporate interests big time in the late 70s. They were persuaded by Tony Coelho, who was a congressman from California, that they could raise as much money as the Republicans. And that dramatically closed the difference between the two parties. It began to be harder to get congressional hearings on major hazards and major necessities. You couldn't get access to the regulatory agencies. The corporate lobbyists were swarming over Washington. They put their executives in high government positions, regardless of whether it was a Democrat or Republican in the White House. So the bankers put their person in the Treasury Department, and the military companies put in the Defense Department, and so on. And then there were 400 political action committees in 1974, and within a decade, there were 9,000, and most of them were commercially driven. There was the auto dealers and the insurance agents, the oil companies and the banks, and copper companies and timber companies, you name it. And they put money in both parties. So they hedged their bets beautifully. The drug companies, example of that. And they got a lot. They got tax breaks. They got subsidies. They got guaranteed markets. They got immunities from prosecution. They got huge contracts and grants from the government, Department of Interior, Agriculture, Defense Department. So Washington is, you know, corporate occupied territory.
Absolutely.
It's an accounts receivable now for these corporations. So then I said, well, you know, if Washington is closing down on citizen groups, and there were conservative citizen groups complaining too, if they couldn't have access, they couldn't have voice, they had members in the millions around the country, but their offices in Washington couldn't get much done, then maybe you have to go into the electoral system. That was the next fork in the road. And even though I knew that the two parties rigged the system from A to Z against third parties like no other Western country, I still wanted to at least put the progressive agenda on the map, keep the flame alive, organize the people who wanted a voice and wanted a better choice, get more young people learning about the skills of clean election campaigning, and hopefully get on the debates, the presidential debates.
Right,
but
right.
We couldn't do that, even though there were several polls, Terrence, that had a majority of people wanted me on those debates.
Yeah, no, we will talk just a little bit about the debates because you've played a role in them and because I think many people are not quite so clear how those things operate. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Ralph Nader about the ideas in his new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. You can learn more at Nader, NADER.org. This thing about there's a lot of headlines and a lot of chatter seems endless, actually. It starts 2 years before the election, seems to go on forever. But we don't actually get a lot of what I would call intelligence. Could you speak a bit about the relationship of citizens and taxpayers to the two major parties' conventions and the two major parties' debates?
Well, the citizens have low expectation levels. I say if you have low expectation levels, and you lose before you start because the politicians know how to respond to low expectation levels. For example, look at the national conventions, the political conventions of the Republican-Democratic Party, one in Republicans in Tampa and the Democrats in Charlotte. How many people know that their tax dollars are going to support those private corporations called the Republican National Committee and the Democrat National Committee? $50 million goes to Tampa. $50 million is appropriated by Congress indirectly through the checkoff, goes to Charlotte.
And no other party receives taxpayer funds, right?
No other party receives it. But what are these $50 million? They're used to hire masses of police to keep demonstrators a mile away from the convention hall so that they can't make their needs and wants known under the First Amendment. And they often do it in a very rough way. And then the two parties get $18.2 million each just for their parties, you know, they control the Congress, right? And they say, okay, let's flip $18.2 million of your tax dollars to the Democrats and the same to the Republicans. And mind you, these are not official agencies. These are private companies, and they should pay for their own parties.
Yes, yes, their own conventions, their own gatherings, exactly.
Especially as there's no more suspense. You know, everybody
right.
knows who the nominee is.
It's a TV show.
The platform is rigged and finished. There's no debate on the platform. And you see, if people were really holding the reins in this country, if they saw themselves really as we the people, that's the preamble to our Constitution. It is not we the corporations. None of this would happen. Let me put it this way. We've heard about the 1% of the rich from the Occupy movement.
Right.
And we've heard about the 99% of the rest of the people. I have another 1%. 1% of the people, that's about 3 million people, organized in congressional districts, focusing on Congress, turning Congress around, and also doing a lot of other things, can turn the entire country around. In other words, it is true that 1% control a lot of power in this country. But the other 1% of engaged, serious citizens organized with one another across congressional districts, turning the power of Congress, the power to spend, to tax, to declare war, to investigate, to confirm nominees, turning it in the favor of the people, it will happen. Just ask yourself, was it less than 1% of the people who started the Pacifica radio programs? Of course. The Pacifica radio stations serve everybody. Anybody can turn on to them. Anybody can call to them. And yet it was a fraction of 1% that did this. In fact, if you look back in our history, the major movements toward justice involved seriously less than 1% of the people, other than the Civil War. In other words, the suffrage movement for women's right to vote, there never was more than 1% really seriously doing this day after day. And so this book, 17 Solutions, is designed to put in people's hands a whole range of opportunities to make life better for their neighborhood and country and world, and also to turn around their taxes so they don't go by way of military bloated contracts and wars of aggression. They don't go to corporate welfare. They don't go to subsidies in Wall Street. They don't go indirectly by tax loopholes and tax havens. They come back and rebuild your community. Good jobs, schools, clinics, water, sewage systems, public buildings, public transit, the latest technology. There's a chapter here on science and technology for the people, converting to solar and energy efficiency technologies, replacing nuclear and fossil fuels. We're a country full of problems, Terrence, that we don't deserve, and full of solutions we don't apply.
Yeah, I love that quote. I have it down as one of the things. That's exactly right. We have more problems than we deserve and more solutions than we apply.
I mean, abolishing poverty, that's nothing. Western Europe, until this latest dip, they abolished poverty as we know it. How'd they do it? Well, they had a higher minimum wage. We have the lowest minimum wage in the Western world, $7.25 federal, a little higher in California. But if we adjusted it for inflation from 1968, it would be $10.30. So you have 30 million workers making less than the workers made in 1968, adjusted for inflation. One way, another way to get rid of poverty, full Medicare for all. Just like a majority of the people want an inflation-adjusted minimum wage, including Rick Santorum and, until earlier this year, Mitt Romney,
right.
A majority of people want full Medicare, single payer. And majority doctors want it as well. Majority nurses want it as well. It'll save 45,000 lives a year, according to the Harvard Medical School researchers. 800 Americans die every week because they can't afford health insurance to get diagnosed and treated. Nobody dies in France, Germany, Sweden, Canada because they don't have health insurance. So you see, the whole idea of the 17 traditions is to say to people, you want this? You show you want it. Okay, you want it. It's in your hands, and it's a lot easier than you think.
Yeah, I want to
organize the 1%. The 1% in your community, as long as what you're pushing for has the public sentiment behind, that is, you have a majority of people who silently support what you're doing, you're going to win.
What you're saying is it doesn't take a lot of people if a lot of people agree with you.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know who saw that? It was Abraham Lincoln. He said, with public sentiment, you can do anything. Now, we have a huge consensus here. This idea of a polarized society, that's a manipulative technique by the ruling classes who want to divide everybody into conservative or liberal, never converge, Republican, Democrat, never converge. But when you get down to where people live, work, play, raise their families, sleep, have fun, there's a tremendous consensus. People want good recreational facilities for exercise and unorganized sports in their community. People want to breathe clean air, drink clean water, eat safe food. They want a living wage for their laborers going to work every day. They want some security for their retirement. They want law and order for the big boys, not just for the street crime. They want pushing peace. Well, I mean, 70% of the people want us to get out of Afghanistan yesterday.
Yeah.
And there's no party pushing for that. So, in other words, just their own intuition, their own sense of practicality, of fairness. What are we doing over there? We're just spreading Al-Qaeda into 20 countries. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, no Al-Qaeda in Libya, no Al-Qaeda in Somalia, no Al-Qaeda in Yemen, no Al-Qaeda now in Mali as a result of our attack on Libya, which is now in chaos, by the way. There's now Al-Qaeda moving into Syria. I mean, the main promoter of Al-Qaeda is the U.S. government, U.S. government policy, overreacting, blowing countries apart, killing civilians, some of whom young men join Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, what you get to, if I'm not mistaken, what you have is two things. One, you have enormous youth and enormous poverty in a lot of these countries, and then you have an attack, an aggression, and you put those two together, and it's not hard to organize.
And 24-hour drones, you don't know when they're going to strike. I mean, the British in World War II, when the Luftwaffe would fly over and bomb London, they could hear it. It would go on for a couple hours, then it would be over. 24 hours a day, these drones, it's terrifying the kids, the babies, the children. They don't know where they're going to strike. The young men can't congregate because under U.S. Obama policy, if they have a suspect targeted and there are a bunch of young men around the suspect, that's assumed to be a bunch of insurgents, and they blow them up with pushing buttons from Virginia or Nevada. So there's a strong animosity to this kind of empire in conservative circles, libertarian circles, liberal progressive circles, but they're not organized. And so you went right to the core, Terrence, which is how do you develop the tools of organizing?
Right.
And there are several ways in this book.
I'm Terrence McNally, talking with Ralph Nader. The new book is The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for American Future. You can learn a lot more at nader.org. Okay, Ralph, organizing.
Well, just extend what you just said. You want my weekly column electronically free, just visit nader.org, sign up. And if you want to get an autographed copy of this book directly, just go to 17 Solutions, that's spelled out, 17solutions.com. And you'll get an autographed book. It's a paperback. It's not that expensive. You can have a discussion with your neighbors, your friends, your extended family, schools. I poured a lot of experience in this book, Terrence. I know how to connect not only the redirections or the goals, but the instruments to get to the goals, the tools of democracy to get to the goals. And that's what we've got to do. And they go together. Because if you have great goals, but you have no power to get there to overcome the power structure, displace the power structure, you're going to get disillusioned, burnout, dropout, and then you'll just, you know, become an introvert in terms of your private life without a public citizen life.
Let me read a quote, which just to say, we'll bounce around here then. Let's go to this piece right now, Ralph. But let me read a quote. I interviewed Don Bartlett and James Steele recently on their betrayal of the American dream. Then I interviewed Hedrick Smith on who stole the American dream. And both of them, you know, when it gets to the solutions part, it's tough. But one quote from Smith struck me, and I'm just going to use it to set up what we're going to talk about. He says, in 1963, 200,000 civil rights advocates marched on Washington. There's a lesson for us today in that scene, a lesson not just from the march, but from other populist movements of the 60s and 70s. These were important manifestations of people power, of the political power of average Americans to shape public policy, to make government work for ordinary citizens, not just for the financial elite. Most Americans today feel powerless. And then he quotes a populist organizer, Ernie Cortez, who says, not only does power corrupt, but powerlessness corrupts. It drains the lifeblood out of democracy and corrodes the idealism of the body politic. That's what you're aiming to shift, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because when you feel powerless, you get cynical. When you feel cynical, you leave the terrain to the rascals. They want you to be cynical. And they make you cynical by showing that you can't count, you don't matter, you can't fight City Hall, you can't fight Congress, you can't fight ExxonMobil. I mean, that's the time-tested way that the top 1% controls it. They control it by making you think they're all powerful and you have no power. Now, for example, let's say we want to organize thousands of consumer, environmental, small taxpayer groups so we can start competing electorally and in the councils of government, state and federal. Okay, so few people turn out to town meetings from returning members of Congress, the Senate and the House, mm-hmm. 535 men and women. They go back and recess and they have these meetings. They're lucky if 20, 30, 40 people turn out. If this is a hot issue, maybe more. My estimate is anybody who can credibly say to a senator or a representative that we're going to turn out 200 to 300 people in this high school auditorium, we'll get that senator and representative to that auditorium. in person, not a flack, not a staff. You realize how little that is?
Yeah. Now,
what happens when you get them in the room? Because you summon them on your agenda. You say, okay, the agenda this time is out of control corporate power. We're not going to talk about anything else, Senator. We're not going to talk about abortion. We're not going to talk about speculation tax. We're going to talk generically about corporations have too much power over our economy, our workers, commercializing childhood, our elections, our politics, our government. They even want to own our genes, Monsanto style. We are going to talk about corporate power. And so the people in the audience are in charge. Now, is that hard to do? One of the principles of this book is don't make excuses for yourself. When you have all kinds of unused rights and power that you've given up on yourself and not used. So start using what you can use without anybody stopping you. Can people stop you from marching, rallying, voting for a third-party candidate? Can people stop you from going to small claims court? Can people stop you from organizing community economies, farmer to consumer farms, cooperative credit union, local renewable energy, wind farms? Can people stop you from doing all these things that attract people's consumer dollars away from Citigroup, Bank of America, ExxonMobil, Pfizer, and so on, when you develop these community economies? And I have a chapter on making communities more self-reliant, and that's one of them. Nobody can stop you from doing that. So stop stopping yourself. That's the key. Now, there are some people who don't even think about being active. They're so involved in getting through the day. Half the people in the country are poor.
Right.
Lucky if they have a job. But so, and those are the people that you have to attract, that if you happen to be a little bit more involved than they are, you can be more effective if you bring them in. And you watch their eyes light up. You think people like to go through life on their knees? You think they like to go through life eating their grievances, being shut out, excluded, underpaid, underinsured, disrespected? I mean, the whole country can turn around faster than anything because we're blessed with a lot of reserves. Do we have enough capital for investment? Are you kidding?
Oh, my God,
It's the people's capital sitting there piled up in these corporations who don't even pay enough dividends to their owners.
I'm Terrence McNally. That's the passionate voice of Ralph Nader. We're talking about his new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for American Future. You can learn more at nader.org. And this book, as he points out, I noticed it didn't come out in hardback, right?
No, it came out in paperback. We
By
want
choice.
To have a fast distribution here. You know, 17solutions.com. We can get it directly, get it in bookstores, get it online. I want to, Terrence, just very quickly to give people a sense of the depth of the book, because they might say, what do you mean 17 solutions? Is this a list of wonky policy recommendations? Well, here they are, and just think what you think of when you hear them. Fundamental tax reform. First, we tax what society dislikes the most before we tax work. So we tax pollution. We tax Wall Street speculation. We tax addictive products. I mean, why do we tax labor before we tax hundreds and hundreds of trillions of dollars of speculation in Wall Street that can produce billions of dollars to put back in the community?
What you're saying is a minute tax on the
yes.
the volume of trades that happen nowadays. People know about this, that you're buying and selling stock. It doesn't even matter anymore because there's this speculation going on by computers at enormous volumes. Well, you put just a minute, we're talking about 0.1 cent per trade, that kind of thing? I mean, it's really minute, right?
Look what the sales tax in California is.
8.75, I think, at this point in LA.
You go into a store, you buy necessities of life, you pay 7-8%. You know, someone buys $100 million of Exxon derivatives today and pays not a penny.
And sells them in a minute.
One half of 1%, you'll raise over $300 billion.
Billion, exactly. Okay.
Right. So the motto is tax what we burn before we tax what we earn.
Exactly.
Tax what we bet before we tax what we net. And then making our communities more self-reliant. That refers to what I just mentioned. More cooperative credit institutions, more renewable energy, farmer to market, community health clinics focusing on prevention, more exercise, recreational facilities, etc. Give science technology back to the people. Science technology has been heavily hijacked for massive military research and development, for massive corporate technologies of automation replacing workers. Now it's starting to move toward massive conversion toward renewable energy, solar energy. Why did it take so long? Because the people didn't have the power. The oil and coal and nuclear companies had the power. Protect the family unit from commercialization. Here's one that really appeals to very conservative people.
Across the board.
Yeah, across the board. The corporations have dropped all social restraints here. When I was a kid growing up, they maybe directly tried to sell us bubble gum.
Right.
But not much else. Now, there's a multi-billion dollar marketing drive bypassing parental authority, undermining parental authority, going right for the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, tens and tens of billions of dollars direct marketing, much of it very harmful. Junk food, obesity, junk drink, obesity, violent programming, soft pornography, cosmetics for girls at age 6 and 7, destructive war toys for the boys. I mean, they're destroying the family unit.
It's not even what you listed were the things that have obviously negative consequences, but even the ones that you might even say are neutral, is still this incredible drive to define yourself as a consumer first.
Yeah.
And that's who you are, and that's what gives you status, that's what makes you cool, and any other definition of yourself is left out, which is why we have males in schools having so much trouble in a social situation thinking that it's good to be smart, even, because they've been taught this other thing.
Fights over shoes, envy over clothes, squabbles inside family households over these products, and, well, so-and-so has them, I want them, and it's just a nightmare.
Yeah.
You just get parents going on that, they'll fill volumes. Getting corporations off welfare, crony capitalism, again, a convergence between liberals and conservatives, subsidies, handouts, giveaways. Most people don't know that the gold and silver on federal land is given away free to any company, foreign or national, who discovers it, whether it's California federal land, Nevada federal land. Canadian company years ago discovered $9 billion, with a B, dollars of our gold on federal land, Nevada. They got it for $30,000.
Right. I mean, that I underlined. And what it is that, as you say, it's the 1872, I believe, Mining Act, which means they took whatever value it might have had in 1872, and that has not been changed. And as you say, foreign or domestic, and we're talking public lands, lands we own.
That's right. And one of the points in this book is a greater awareness of what we own but don't control. We own the Commonwealth in this country. We own one-third of America, the public lands. We own the public airways. We own trillions of dollars of research and development in the last 70 years that have built the major industries free, the taxpayers free. They built the aerospace, the containerization, the semiconductor, the computer industry, the biotech industry,
pharmaceutical. Yep.
See, so once we start saying to the senators in that town meeting, we want to control what we own, they'll be so baffled that anybody even focuses on it once you get them in a high school auditorium. These giant corporations should no longer be chartered in Delaware or Nevada, permissible jurisdictions. They should be nationally chartered so we can have completely different compact between the people who, through their state government, create the charters for these corporations and these corporations.
Let me ask you a quick question on that one.
Yeah.
Would that apply at a certain level? In other words, the size of the corporation?
Yes.
So at a certain size of corporation, you have to be nationally chartered. You can't cherry-pick
about $100 million in sales.
You can't cherry-pick the state that gives you the best deal.
Yeah, exactly. And here's one. Restore our civil liberties. That goes without saying. I mean, this whole war on terror has shredded our civil liberties, produced fear, which Eisenhower warned about, so beautifully in his speech. Reinvest in public works. We know that.
I mean, but, let me just jump.
Here's what people don't know. The biggest consumer in the United States is the federal, state, and local government. They buy almost everything we buy, plus things we don't buy, like missiles. But they buy food. They buy paper. They buy motor vehicles. They buy energy. They buy housing. They buy clothing. And so years ago, we started, and Barry Commoner just passed away, the greatest environmentalist of the 20th century, would say to the Pentagon, you know, if you start buying photovoltaics for your remote locations, if you start buying the kind of renewable energy for your far-flung installations, you will spur innovation, and you will create the basis for a larger civilian economy. It is amazing. I got seatbelts in cars by persuading the federal agency called General Services Administration to buy 40,000 cars for federal employees with seatbelts, with the airbags.
You mean before
once that happened?
Before they were regulated.
Huh?
Before they were regulated, they had to have it.
Yeah, we couldn't get them regulated. The auto companies blocked us at the Department of Transportation, so we went around the corner to the GSA, who was headed by a former auto parts supplier, Republican from New Hampshire, so he was in no awe of the auto industry. And it was perfect. Once that occurred, Chrysler, Ford, GM, they all fell into line, and then the foreign companies did.
Government procurement, as I think it's 20% of all purchasing in America happens through all the different levels of government. Once they decide they want recycled this or they want whatever efficient that, once they decide it and they do it, and again, this is the people we own, this is the systems we own, then the price comes down. That's what it takes.
Tremendous tool if they block the regulators. Tremendous tool, you know. Customer is always right. We've got the symbols on our side. The military budget, $800 billion. There are military officials say we could more than defend our country for $300 billion. Imagine $500 billion repairing America every year, bringing the soldiers back, spending the money to give them a college education. The other one is reengage with civic life and invent new tools for reform. Here's one. You summon the members of Congress to your town meeting. You jam it. You say, look, we want power. You understand that, Senator? We want power. That's what the Constitution is supposed to be about, citizen power. And we want to have a facility that makes it easy for us to band together as workers into unions, band together as consumers into co-ops, band together insurance policy holders and bank customers into consumer advocacy groups, so we can take on directly the big boys and fill your congressional hearings with the people side of the story for months. So they say, oh, what do you have in mind, people? The senator says. Well, here's what we have in mind. You go back to Washington, and along with the subsidies that you give your big friends in Wall Street and elsewhere, we want you to pass a law to require inserts electronically and through the postal in all bills and statements from corporations, banks, credit card, insurance companies, you name it, inviting us to join together and form our own nonprofit consumer advocacy group with our own lawyers, investigators, engineers, accountants, so we can defend ourselves and so we can turn you around if you are subjected to the temptations of corporate lobbyists. Now, Senator, this is something that's voluntary for us to join. This is something that doesn't cost the taxpayer anything. And it's just a little quid pro quo for all the goodies you give these corporations. What do we get in return? You cannot believe how fast this will happen. We almost got it through during the savings and loan crisis, but we didn't have the town meetings back home with a fraction of 1% of the people filling those chairs.
Let me ask you to clarify that one a little more. So, in other words, the federal government, their role in this is merely to say that all such communications from financial entities have to include this message?
Invitation for people to band together and defend themselves in terms of the price of the service, the quality of telecommunication, the fine print contracts, the grievance procedures, negotiating, just like labor unions used to negotiate with corporations. You have these consumer groups, regionally, locally, nationally, millions of members with very sharp champions sitting at the table, rewriting the whole fine print contract rule, which we call contract peonage. Check out faircontracts.org for our project there. So this is just one of many. By the way, the referendum has been hijacked a good deal by the corporation.
Now, when you say referendum, are you also taking into, does that include like the propositions and initiatives on the California ballot?
Yeah, they were designed by Governor Hiram Johnson of California, as we know, 100 or so years ago, to be the voice of the people. They would be the legislature. When the people in Sacramento didn't do the job, when they fell flat before these corporate barons, the people could put their proposal. And California has done some good things. They've done some pretty bad things because the corporations have hijacked, and they're doing it now for November. Governor Brown wants Proposition 30 to raise, restore some taxes on the wealthy, and, you know, they're putting a lot of money against that. The tobacco company beat a recent initiative in California to increase taxes on tobacco products, a rare win recently for the tobacco industry.
That's right.
But if people really grabbed the reins the way the People's Lobby did so wonderfully with Ed and Joyce Kupel in Los Angeles before both of them fell for because of cancer, they were voluntarily qualifying statewide initiatives with a network of volunteers with clipboards getting signatures on petitions. That was going to be one of the greatest grassroots democracy movements in American history. But anyway, people can do that. You've got that. I come from Connecticut. We don't have that kind of referendum. We've got to rely on the state legislature.
Yeah, but here, I mean, as you know, Ralph, here, as you say, it has been taken over. Now, people are paid to get the signatures. The initiatives that they put on the ballot are constructed so that they are open to false advertising, and then they put tons of money, unlimited amounts of money from corporate coffers into the false advertising, which will give them a chance. And sometimes they will put two different ones that seem to compete on the ballot just to make it confusing and so on. Now,
on the other hand, in 1988, Harvey Rosenfield and I qualified an initiative in California to restrain the growth of auto insurance prices. Okay, the insurance company threw $80 million against us. I mean, that's almost a record even now. We had $2 million. We beat them. Why did we beat them? Because we had a grassroots network all over the country, all over California.
Yeah.
Number two, people were really upset with skyrocketing auto insurance. And three, the media covered us. We had a regular reporter on the L.A. Times that covered it again and again and again. So we know what the pieces are to put it together. We know what the energy level is necessary. We can take these corporations and scat them out of town with the power of the people. Once the people organize the power, the corporations become like pussycats. What can we do for you? Oh, you want us to change? Fine. You want us to have a different product? Fine. You want us to correct the fine print? Fine. Do you want us to be honest in our warranty? Fine. I mean, look at the history. The greatest things that came from our forebears were supported by a tiny fraction of 1% involved people, but they represented the public sentiment of much larger numbers: Social Security, progressive income tax, labor, fair labor standards, minimum wage, regulation of banks vis-a-vis farmers. So this book is designed to get people really going. I see too many good people in this country are discouraged.
Right.
And that's a very bad sign. And the subtext of this book is, it's in your hands, people, and it's a lot easier than you think. And I might add, as a footnote, it's a lot of fun.
I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Ralph Nader. We're talking about his new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. You can learn more at nader.org.
Hey there, folks. This is Leslie Marshall. Would you like another great way to hear the show? Let me tell you about the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. It makes it even easier to take the live show with you wherever you go. The PV channel on TuneIn features me, Leslie Marshall, The Leslie Marshall Show, and all your favorite progressive shows, plus features you'll only hear on TuneIn. So tune in to the only true democracy in talk radio of, for, and by you, the people, on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, Truth Seekers. This is Mike Malloy, and I want to invite you to join me around the nightly campfire live each weeknight from 9 to midnight on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneInRadio.com. You'll hear 3 hours of Take No Prisoners, fiery progressive political talk radio, too dangerous for daylight hours. Find out why Truth Seekers everywhere end their day screaming with me each night. So go to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn Radio now and look for the Mike Malloy Show. It's talk radio like you've never heard before.
I'm Terrence McNally, talking with Ralph Nader. The new book is The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for American Future. You can learn a lot more at nader.org. Let me ask you one thing. I'm going to ask you two questions. One, let's say we had the recent effort to pass health care reform. What is, from everything you've been saying about how the people have so much power, clearly, when you talked about what you did with the auto insurance initiative, I mean, nowadays people know that the healthcare industry is screwing them. They know that, you know, that people are getting bounced from a policy for these, you know, previous conditions and all of these things. They're angry, and yet the people could not be mobilized. Why was that so, and how would we change that?
Okay, here, good question. First of all, ask yourself, was single-payer full Medicare for all on the table in Washington? No. The Democrats took it off the table. Obama wouldn't even invite the leading exponent of it, the leading physician who was a friend of his in Chicago, Quentin Young, wouldn't even invite him to the White House for the meetings around which were the health insurance executives,
yeah,
drug company executives.
Yeah.
All right. So there was not one full-time organizer. The labor unions said, well, single payer is a great thing, but Obama's taken it off the table, so why have any organizers? So the first question is, how do we get funding for organizers in every congressional district? Most changes are always preceded by the number of organizers. Civil rights was an example. It was when the organizers went in the field, things started to happen, not just the lawyers filing lawsuits. Okay, so there's a section in the book called Enlist the Enlightened Super Rich.
Yes, I like
that. 98% of the super rich could maybe care less other than themselves and their families and their little golf outings. All you need is a handful of enlightened billionaires. In fact, I could say to people, show me a billionaire, and you know, there are billionaires now worth 15, 20, 30 billion. Gates is worth 50, Buffett is worth 55 billion. $1 billion would have got a single payer. That is, that would have hired
enough organizers.
Organizers all over, like Ernie Cortez type, organizers all over the country, focusing on each member of Congress. Already about 25% of the members of Congress were supporters of single-payer to begin with, but they were muzzled by Obama, who wanted to go with Obamacare and provide huge profits for the insurance and drug companies, which is why he got them on their side.
That's right. In other words, let's remember that the people that the public is angriest at, which is the insurance companies and the pharmacists, they're the ones you are now mandated to buy their product.
Yes.
That's what the law does, when in fact, as we say, Medicare for all, if it works so well once you're at that age, just, I mean, and it could have been, I mean, I'm, you know, now we're talking tactics, but it could have been, you know, it goes to 55 this year, it goes to 50 2 years from now, it goes to 45 2 years from then, et cetera, et cetera. It made eminent common sense.
Yeah, because where it is in Canada, Canadians cover everything. Everybody for half the price.
Right.
They cover about $4,400 per capita. We're $8,500, and we have 50 million people who aren't covered at all. They have better outcomes in Canada. The doctors practice medicine, not bookkeeping. Stock options.
Well, I mean,
the
overhead in Medicare is like 3 to 4%. The overhead in insurance is like 20%.
Yeah,
that's $16.
Lives, of course.
That's 16% that doesn't go to your health.
Right. So allows more prevention, focus on prevention. At any rate, you have $1 billion. You say to some rich guy, look, do you really want to change America and go down in history as one of the greatest Americans? we will show you how to use $1 billion, and we're going to do it fast, because reforms often that are stretched out, they lose, because they give the opposing companies a lot of time to get their hooks into a lot of legislators in the system.
And nibble away at it, yeah.
Harry Truman recommended universal health insurance, and we're still waiting.
Yeah.
So, now, we've got to get some of the enlightened super rich, you know. There are 80 of them that have pledged to Gates and Buffett. They're going to spend over half their wealth on good works. But a lot of them, and they tell me this, when I talk to some of them, they don't know what really to do outside of normal traditional charity. They don't know how to mobilize communities so that the reforms become self-replicating and they become very fundamental in terms of shift of power and policy.
Let me ask you a question, because I imagine, I mean, you have that class of 55 thing that you guys organized at Princeton, probably has a few billionaires in it. But what you've been talking to these people, my guess is that many of them say they don't want to deal in politics. Am I correct?
Yes, but they don't have to.
Yeah.
All they have to do is support the civic groups or help start the civic groups that then will carry the water all the way to Washington. In fact, I outline this in great detail, as you know, Terrence, in my political fiction book called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. That's
right.
The quote. And I use real-life multi-billionaires like Ted Turner, Warren Buffett, working together top-down, bottom-up, turning the country around. And the strategies and tactics are very realistic. Once the money is there and the influence of the billionaires, a lot flows. People are waiting, ready. But they have to have tools. They have to have expenses paid, transportation, mobilization. Organizers have to earn a livelihood if they're going to hit the road. But it all can be done. You see, it all comes down to our expectation level. If we cannot imagine a better future for our country and world, we will not be able to envision the real possibilities that are at hand. And what commercialism does and what corporatism does is to stifle that imagination.
Exactly.
At the earliest age of these little children.
Right.
From the beginning.
Yeah, is what you're saying.
Stuff them full of video, violence, and entertainment, and salacious junk food.
Colonize their imaginations.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I'm going to ask you two questions, and we've got about 3 minutes, okay?
Yeah.
The first one is a quick response to the Occupy movement.
We had a great beginning, with a 99% slogan, terrific, that unified people so they didn't fight each other over identity politics. They had the right tactic. The marches wouldn't have got attention, but they had the encampments 24/7. That got the mass media. But they so avoided anything called leaders or leadership. I don't mind avoiding leaders, but I do mind avoiding leadership. They didn't know how to take the next step once they were evicted. That doesn't mean they're gone. They're still bubbling around here and there, helping people on
foreclosures and that sort of thing. Yeah.
But basically, it's a spent force. And I try to encourage and talk to many of them to take up the cudgels for 30 million workers.
Minimum wage.
$10 minimum wage.
Just make that the first demand.
Yeah. They could have surrounded every congressional office back home, took it at, the same time, and 70% of the people with them, even right-wing politicians, it infuses the economy with more consumer demand. Obama is on the record as favoring 950 in the year 2011, back in 2008. I mean, what more do you need, for heaven's sake? And they would have been the champions of 30 million workers, including conservative workers in Walmart.
Yep. And by the way, you point out the 2011 study by the Chicago Federal Reserve. Every dollar increase in the wage of a minimum wage worker results in 2,800 consumer spending from that worker's household in a year. I mean,
there it is.
And you contrast
more jobs.
It's so much lower than anywhere else in the world. And as you say, 70% of the people. So what you were saying was, you've got these encampments, make one demand. As Frederick Douglass says, a power concedes nothing without demands.
That would have taken them to a massive level of civic and political power. It's still not too late. They can do it for next year.
Exactly. It can still happen. Okay, the last question.
Notice that you'll not see any questions on any of the presidential debates on the minimum wage.
That's right.
Although I've urged and urged it. There's so much off the table on these presidential campaigns that reflects the lack of engagement and the powerlessness of people who should never be viewed as powerless.
That's right. There is always a secret debate contract between the two major parties, and then there's kind of an implicit contract with the media that agrees we won't ask what you guys don't want to talk about.
That's all on opendebates.org, George Farah. I'm sure you interviewed him yet.
I haven't yet. No.
Oh, he's the great exposer.
Yeah.
Oh, he's all over. He was on Amy Goodman. He's really good on that subject.
Okay. Let me see. We're at 56 minutes. We probably should wrap it up now. Ralph, this has been wonderful. I must say, I didn't read 17 Traditions, and I've heard it's a wonderful book. But when I saw I try at this show to be solution-centered. That's why I say I believe we can do better. I want to find out how. And when I saw that your new book was Solutions, my eyes lit up. Thank you for this hour, and thank you for the last 50 years.
And thank you. Remember, 17solutions.com.
Yep.
And there's a chapter called Get Congress to Have Skin in the Game, which means no wars unless all children and grandchildren age qualified, able-bodied of members of Congress are instantly drafted into the armed services. That'll make them concentrate on their constitutional authority, not to give the power to declare war to an out-of-controlled imperial presidency. That's in the book.
Very good. The book is The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for American Future. The website is nader.org, where he is putting something new up at least once a week, and you can subscribe to that. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests, issues, some articles of background, you can sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally@mac.com. Thank you, Ralph Nader. Keep up the good work.
Always will, and I hope all of you will too.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Check out my show at davidpakman.com. That's David, P-A-K-M-A-N.com.
Gay marriage in Texas by Easter? That's exactly what one attorney says who is representing two couples that are challenging the Texas ban on gay marriage in federal court. A lot happening last night at midnight. Florida, Lewis, starting same-sex marriages, and Daniel McNeil Lane Jr. of Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld in San Antonio makes the prediction that there will be same-sex marriage in Texas by Easter. Remember that U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia already struck down the Texas ban on gay marriage, but it was immediately stayed because, of course, it was appealed by then-Attorney General Greg Abbott. We will eventually get a decision. The Fifth Circuit Court unveiled they have put in place a three-judge panel to decide on this. Lewis, would you have imagined 5 years ago that in the first half of 2015, we would see 30 states with legal same-sex marriage, and that Florida would be one of them, and that Texas might be next?
No. I would have assumed Texas would have been one of the last five states to have it. But in Florida, look, they've got the right idea here, because if you can marry inanimate objects in Florida, I think you should be able to marry another human being that you love.
No question. I mean, people often oppose gay marriage because they say, hey, if two dudes can get married, all of a sudden a woman will be marrying a train. You didn't need that in Florida. They haven't had gay marriage, and women have already been marrying trains and Ferris wheels and who knows what else. So it's a good point. It seems actually, Lewis, that being able to marry inanimate objects came way ahead of just saying, hey, two people who love each other can get married.
It really did. But at least, perhaps they found some solace in the fact that there probably won't be a divorce between a person and an inanimate object.
I don't know. I used to really like going to amusement parks, and I've really become kind of disheartened, and it's not really my thing anymore. And if I were married to the Batman ride at Six Flags in Massachusetts, I could see having divorced that ride by now.
Oh, perhaps. Yeah. I guess you could have a change of heart.
Seriously, though, we have more pressing issues to deal with. Let's get this over with. Let's let people get married and move on to solving our more important problems.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and much more, check out our website, davidpakman.com. That's David, P-A-K-M-A-N.com. And check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.